In 2005, people in West Virginia and Ohio were asked to donate blood and answer some personal questions. Scientists hoped to find out if a synthetic PFAS chemical, referred to by the company DuPont as C8, was linked to diseases.
The settlement is far from the end of the C8 case. It merely sets into motion a blood test process which six different water districts are eligible to take.
The study was part of a court settlement against DuPont.
The problem is when you ask people to volunteer for a study, not many people are going to show up. And so who's going to do this?
We want to get this thing up and running because the momentum was there, the case had been settled. So we put a lot of information out in ads and pamphlets, you name it, every flooded the market.
Healthy drinking water is vital to all of us. That's why scientists need to know if the chemical C8 causes any health problems. By completing a health questionnaire and having your blood tested, you can help. And you may be paid up to $400. To get started, call 1-800.
DuPont remains confident the test results will prove C8 is safe. But a lot depends on how many take the test.
The money helped draw people in, but would enough show up to produce robust results? And after years of fighting DuPont in court, how much longer would people in the communities of West Virginia and Ohio be prepared to wait for answers?
One of the things that was sort of an unknown at the time was how long this process would take. It ended up taking more than 7 years.
It's the largest human health study in the history of the world in terms of its breadth and scope.
Welcome to the Poison Detectives Podcast, a production of Canada's National Observer. This podcast is made possible by the Dragonfly Fund in collaboration with the Institute of Sustainability in Education and Action. Among the Dragonfly priorities is working towards a toxic-free world for the health of people and the planet. I'm Sandra Bartlett, and this is Episode 3, The Best Regulations Money Can Buy.
So this is my office, and I spend an awful lot of time sitting in front of my computer. I just thought you might be interested in the start of a couple talks that I've given recently.
Linda Birnbaum is a toxicologist and microbiologist who worked at the highest levels of health and environmental research in the U.S. for more than 40 years. She invited me to her home office in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, to talk about her work.
So I'm Linda Birnbaum. I'm the former director and currently a scientist emeritus at the National Institutes of Health, specifically the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. And I was also the director of the National Toxicology Program, which is a program that not only involves NIH, but also involves the CDC and the FDA.
She retired in 2019 because she was tired of being muzzled. Her job was to do research so she could warn regulators of toxic chemicals. But Linda says her warnings were often criticized and dismissed by industry and politicians.
When I retired from NIEHS, I actually got rid of about 60 plaques.
Linda's showing me the photos and plaques that span her career. She wasn't a regulator, but she's learned a lot about how her science and those of her colleagues was used or ignored by regulators. She was one of the scientists at the forefront of warning about some of the most toxic substances ever created.
I worked closely with several veterans groups related to dioxins and Agent Orange. And I have two different plaques that are very meaningful there. One is from a group of Air Force veterans called the Trash Haulers. And they were veterans who were told, oh, you didn't have any exposure just because you flew the planes after the Agent Orange was sprayed many years later. And in fact, there was lots of dioxin stuck on the walls of the planes and so on.
Dioxin was used during the Vietnam War to kill foliage on the ground. But both the Vietnamese and U.S. soldiers were poisoned by it. It caused cancer, birth defects, and neurological problems. It wasn't banned until 1979, 4 years after the end of the Vietnam War. Grandchildren of Vietnam vets are still being damaged by the chemical. But Linda Birnbaum says even back then, when it was clear that something was toxic, there was often still pushback.
Consultants or industry groups that would challenge me and talk to their legislators, and the legislators would talk to the agency muckety-mucks and question what I was saying or what my agency was saying.
Linda's interest in solving scientific questions began when she was growing up in New Jersey.
When I was 13, for my science fair project, and this was in junior high school, for some reason I was very interested in the thyroid gland. So I decided I wanted to do a project. So I wrote to a bunch of drug companies. I grew up in northern New Jersey, and at the time there were lots of drug companies. And one of the president of one of the companies responded to me. And he said, I'll be happy to give you rats and everything you need to take care of them.
Try that today. If the president of a drug company answered your email at all, you could expect a sharp no.
So my father drove me up there and we got 40 rats, 4 cages, water bottles, food, bedding, the whole thing that you would need, including some of the chemicals that I would need.
Did you get that? The president of the drug company even gave her the chemicals she would need for her project? She took it all home and away she went, her first research study.
It was a lot of fun. And at the end, I only lost one rat in the study, and that one, it got lost because it escaped.
Her project won an award that got her a trip to a youth science conference and profiled in Life magazine, the People magazine of the day.
It was a lot of positive reinforcement.
Now she wanted to be a scientist. But this was the 1960s.
And women didn't go into science. I mean, women basically had 4 careers. You know, you could be a secretary, you could be a nurse, you could be a teacher, and you could be a librarian. Those were kind of the careers that were promoted for women.
Not only did she become a microbiologist and university professor, she combined that with marriage and motherhood at a time when neither was considered compatible.
So my husband and I were summer camp sweethearts. I went to the University of Rochester because he was there.
She finished graduate school and had her first job and her first child. But after a couple of years, her husband got a faculty position at a university in New York State, and they moved. She couldn't get a job because the university didn't think a faculty wife could also be faculty. Linda found a small university nearby and got a position there and had another baby.
I used to take her into class with me and sit her in the little car. At that point, they had these little car carriers, not like what they have today, and sit her on the floor or on the side of the thing, and I would teach.
After 5 years in upstate New York, it was time for another move.
So I'd followed my husband twice, and that was his turn to follow me. So I started looking for positions. And those were the days that you could kind of reply to an ad in Science magazine and get responses. And I got several, and one of them was from NIEHS and from a brand new program that was being established and headquartered at NIEHS, which was the National Toxicology Program.
The NIH is the National Institutes of Health, the main health agency in the U.S. It dates back to 1887, when it began to offer medical care to merchant seamen. Today, the NIH has 27 separate institutes. Its researchers discovered fluoride to prevent tooth decay, lithium to manage bipolar disorders, and several vaccines. It's ranked number 2 in the world for its contributions to research journals. Harvard University is first. So even back in 1978, when Linda applied for a job at the new toxicology program, the NIH was a big deal.
I would say initially I didn't even know what toxicology was. I actually had to look up what is toxicology.
So you don't even know what the word, like, what is toxicology? They're starting a new program. Nobody said to you,
well, actually, when I came down for the interview, someone did ask me that question, and I had read the definition. And I said, well, you know, it's really interesting because some of the work I've done for the last 4 years involves treating my rats and mice with a number of chemicals.
Toxicology is the study of the harmful effects of drugs and chemicals on people, animals, and the environment. It was a new field of study in the 1970s, and with its creation, science was about to confront the chemical and drug industry.
I think we were understanding that some chemicals that are important industrially might be very dangerous. Some of that understanding came from tragedies. In 1984, Vopal, where a Union Carbide plant exploded and sprayed chemicals over that area. It might have been in Seveso, Italy, and sprayed dioxin over an area near the plant. It may have been the concerns brought back by our veterans from Vietnam.
Those tragedies brought attention to the miracle chemicals that industry was using. In 1976, an explosion at a chemical plant near Milan, Italy, released a cloud of dioxin, which contaminated land and vegetation. More than 2,000 people were treated for dioxin poisoning. Hoffman LaRoche only reported the accident a week later. Bhopal is considered one of the world's worst industrial disasters. Over 500,000 people were exposed to a toxic gas used in a pesticide plant owned by Union Carbide in Bhopal, India, in December 1984. 3,800 people died immediately. And, of course, Agent Orange used in Vietnam. After these tragedies, there were calls to put some controls on chemical industries.
There was some evidence, this is by the late 70s, that PCBs were associated with increased risk of cancer, increased risk of skin lesions, increased risk of a number of different health impacts.
PCBs are a man-made chemical used as a lubricant for transformers and other electrical equipment, later for electrical appliances and refrigerators and TVs. Their dubious claim to fame, they were the first industrial compounds to be banned worldwide because of their extreme toxicity.
TCDD was another chemical.
TCDD is the acronym for dioxins. They're a byproduct of industrial manufacturing, such as chlorine bleaching of paper pulp, smelting, and the production of some herbicides and pesticides.
TCD is known as the most toxic man-made chemical. And at that point in the 70s, we didn't know a lot about it, but we were hearing about Agent Orange.
That's the chemical used during the Vietnam War. The 1970s became known as the environmental decade. In the U.S., the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, was created and started regulating pollutants in the air, water, and solid waste disposal. The Clean Air Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, laws on pollution, endangered species, forest management were all put in place at this time. The curtain had been pulled back on the chemical industry, and it was time for some regulation.
Oh, it was a time, an amazing time, where I think the country, both sides of the aisle, were concerned about the chemicals that we were being exposed to and were willing to regulate them.
This is also Canada's story. The 70s were significant for regulation, except the government was not quite as aggressive in laying out protections from chemicals and pollutants. The Department of Environment was created in 1971, and there were programs to address acid rain, the rain that fell containing chemical pollutants. Other programs monitored marine pollution, endangered species, water quality. But for example, in Canada, there's still no Clean Air Act, and the Drinking Water Protection Act contains only guidelines, no mandatory requirements. During her career, Linda saw the best and the worst of environmental regulations in the U.S.
I mean, today, we have the best regulations that money can buy. And I say that with a great deal of sorrow, but it's the reality. The amount of money that is spent on lobbying to block enforcement, to block new regulations, to block new laws is astounding.
Linda saw that firsthand because she was at both the EPA and the National Institute of Health Sciences, which is one of those institutes at the NIH I mentioned.
In the 1980s, we'd have our Board of Scientific Counsel, which was our external review board, and say we'd be reviewing the status of a given chemical. We would have completed the long-term animal studies, for example, the cancer studies, and we'd be reporting the conclusions.
Reporting the conclusions that could lead to regulation or restrictions on chemical use. But also in the room, arguing against the science was industry.
And you would get easily, for a chemical that was maybe made by one company or two companies, you'd have at least 15 speakers. 14 of them would be chemical consultants hired by that company to talk about why this chemical is not a problem. And you might have one speaker who represented 350 consumer groups.
And that usually led to the chemical remaining in use. She says EPA often bows to industry concerns that the science isn't robust enough to conclude there's a problem. But she says that's just a smokescreen. The science from the agency she worked at was solid and went through several peer reviews.
In the science that you might do, like if people heard that you were doing this science, would that be upsetting to industry?
And the answer is yes, yes, yes. And part of the issue is, it's, and I'm sure you know this, is it's all about the money. And money is what talks. So the industry is unhappy because they think it is affecting or might affect their profit margin. Then they start spending money on lobbyists and legislators to get things happening.
Or they will come after you through your bosses or sympathetic politicians.
That I would get letters from industry groups, like trade groups, that were word to word the same letters that I would get from legislators. All that would change was the letterhead and the signature, basically. So you know that industry was giving those letters, supplying them to the congressmen or the senators.
Linda got in trouble a few times for pointing out what might seem to be obvious and not really controversial, that there were many toxic chemicals in wide use. In 2012, she published an article called "When Environmental Chemicals Act Like Uncontrolled Medicine." She said that just like drugs, chemicals can produce unwanted effects. Here's a quote from the article. "The proliferation of inadequately tested chemicals in commerce may be contributing to the skyrocketing rates of disease." And her article suggested that, like drugs, chemicals needed study and monitoring. Two Republican congressmen wrote a letter to her boss at the National Institute of Health. They called her article a breach of policy and wanted a disclaimer that the article was her personal opinion, not science. Linda wrote the article as the director of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences and the National Toxicology Program. Not exactly a junior scientist. And she wasn't expressing an isolated opinion. The World Health Organization, the United Nations Environmental Program, and the European Commission had all issued similar warnings. Fast forward a few years. In a 2017 opinion piece in the science journal PLOS Biology, Linda repeated her concern about the gaps in the regulations of chemicals. Here's an excerpt. U.S. policy has not accounted for evidence that chemicals in widespread use can cause cancer and other chronic diseases, damage reproductive systems, and harm developing brains at low levels of exposure, once believed to be harmless. Again, she was attacked by politicians who demanded she be fired. But writing the article wasn't really a fireable offense. She was accused of not telling her bosses that the article she was writing would actually be published. She says her bosses used that as a loophole to punish her.
And so it meant that I got no pay raise for that year. I was really upset. I took it very calmly at first, but in retrospect, I probably should have grieved it and said, this is inappropriate, this is interference.
2 years later, she retired. She'd had enough. She was tired of trying to do her job, produce science that could be used to protect Americans, and having to fight industry attacks on the science, that the methodology was flawed, the results are exaggerated, the conclusions are weak.
They'll say, oh, that's not the way to do it, or that concentration is too low. We don't believe the data. And it's amazing how their approach is what I'd call the defense attorney's approach, which is you find something wrong in a paper, so you throw the whole paper out. So they end up, the only papers they end up accepting are the papers that they paid for.
That's pretty much what lawyer Rob Bilott, the poison detective from the last episode, was up against. Rob had sent a detailed report on the dangers of PFAS chemicals, including PFOIA, to the EPA in 2001. It was 19 pages of text and more than 1,000 pages of documents. Radio silence since. Meanwhile, DuPont was saying 3M's animal studies showing cancer and fetal deformities and deaths didn't count because they were done on animals.
But the reason you're doing those studies is to predict the humans. But nevertheless, the company was saying that evidence isn't good enough in court.
After getting the settlement for Wilbur Tennant, Rob could have gone back to his corporate work, defending and advising industry on environmental issues. But he knew so much more than he had sent to the EPA. And if the EPA wouldn't act, he decided he had to keep going, fighting for the people whose drinking water source was near DuPont's Washington Works plant in Parkersburg, Virginia. 70,000 people in West Virginia and Ohio lived near rivers that DuPont was poisoning.
And so when folks came to us and said, can you help us, the rest of the community now, get this out of our water and tell us, what's it going to do to us? You know, drinking this over these decades, can you help us do that? We felt an obligation to do it.
But his law firm, the Taft Law Firm, had never filed a class action lawsuit, a lawsuit to represent a large number of people hurt by the actions of a company.
We're working with big companies. Our clients didn't behave that way. And we were seeing something that was an aberration.
Surprisingly, his law partners agreed he could continue to go after DuPont.
And we believed that when our other clients see these facts and see what was happening here, they would agree that we ought to be taking this on.
In the end, it was just a month after Wilbur Tennant's lawsuit was settled that Rob filed the class action lawsuit accusing DuPont of poisoning community water in West Virginia and Ohio, making people sick or putting them in danger of getting sick.
That case that was, we called the Leach case, that was filed in 2001 for the community.
He dived back into the banker's boxes of documents. Rob says it's clear that DuPont spent a lot of time trying to deal with the contamination. They dug up tons of sludge from the pits around the plant and trucked it over to the dry run landfill and dumped it in there. DuPont had a permit to dump non-hazardous waste into the landfill. But here they were dumping sludge containing PFOIA. How did they get away with it? Rob was reminded over and over again how DuPont did what they wanted because of a catch-22. Why wasn't this dangerous chemical regulated? Because the EPA didn't know it existed. DuPont and 3M were the only ones who knew about the chemical, and they weren't telling anyone. Rob was horrified and angry to read just how much information DuPont had about PFOIA as early as the 60s and 70s and the damage it did, and didn't share it with regulators because there were no regulators.
The US EPA and all of these federal laws, rules, and regulations didn't even come into existence until 1970. And a lot of these federal laws that then dealt with what do you have to tell the EPA about toxic chemicals, those didn't roll out till the late 70s.
But the top-level scientists working for DuPont knew pretty quickly that this family of chemicals was unlike any other ever created. And the DuPont scientists worried.
What will happen when this chemical gets out into the world? And what was particularly concerning to them was this carbon-fluorine structure, because the scientists at DuPont understood that wouldn't break apart. That was extremely strong. So when it got out into the world, it was not likely to break apart or degrade. So what's gonna do to living things?
The scientists started studying what the chemical would do on living things such as rats, mice, guinea pigs, and rabbits. And the news wasn't good. It caused testicular tumors in the rats and cancers in other animals. What would it do to humans?
DuPont starts monitoring its workers. By 1978, they're finding it in their workers' blood. And what they're seeing is not only does it get into human blood, it stays there. The human body doesn't know how to get rid of this man-made stuff, so it stays there and it builds up to higher and higher levels. So I'm looking through all this data, and I'm seeing all these internal studies by DuPont and 3M on rats and monkeys and humans that are showing incredible persistence, bioaccumulation, toxicity, cancer. But I'm not seeing any of this information being shared with any regulatory agencies or with the scientific community or the public. It's all internal. And what I start to realize is the companies have actually decided to withhold that data. They actually made decisions when these laws I mentioned that started coming out in the late 1970s started rolling out saying, hey, you got to alert the EPA if there's hazardous materials.
That's right. When the EPA was created, it knew there were thousands of chemicals in use that it knew nothing about. So there was an honor system. If you discover that your materials or chemicals could be hazardous, tell the EPA.
These companies sat down at that point in time and made a decision. Do we tell the EPA that we now have this stuff, we're finding it in human blood, it's toxic, it's persistent? And the decision? No. We're not going to tell them.
Telling the EPA might lead to regulation. Not telling them, definitely no pesky regulations. This was, of course, illegal. But how would the EPA find out? By this time, DuPont is also making firefighting turnout gear from textiles containing PFOIA to make the gear fire and water resistant. So an ordinary citizen, Diane Cotter, a lawyer, Rob Bilott, and a senior government scientist, Linda Birnbaum, raising the alarm about PFAS chemicals, wanting the regulators to step in and protect the water, the food, the air. But like industry, regulators take a long time to accept what science is saying.
The Poison Detectives will be back in a moment. But first, I want to tell you about an adventure. Ever picture yourself in the middle of nowhere on a sailing yacht? Blue Water Adventures can take you there. Join award-winning expeditions navigating Alaska or the BC coast in pursuit of wildlife and coastal First Nations art and culture. Celebrating 50 years of expedition travel, Blue Water Adventures is a pioneer in ecotourism on the coast. They welcome travelers from around the world for unforgettable educational small group experiences. Visit bluewateradventures.ca today and discover a world beyond yours.
Diane Cotter and Graham Peasley worked closely on the formal study of PFAS. Diane found more than 40 turnout suits, or pieces from turnout suits, delivered them to Notre Dame University and Graham Peasley's team.
And it took a while for my students to work on it. They organized it into year of manufacture, manufacturer type, took out swatches that they cut out.
During the year when the testing was being done, Graham was contacted by the manufacturers. Were they looking for evidence to discredit the study when it came out? Or genuinely curious about the chemicals in the turnout gear? Graham was a gracious host.
And we showed them the lab and showed them the tests we're doing. And they said, well, it doesn't come off. And I gave them the demonstration that, oh yeah, it comes off. Here's a rubber glove and it's got nothing on it. And we can see it rubs off on the rubber glove. And they said, well, how much is that? And I had the student tell them. And then I saw the guy's eyes widen a little bit, but they kept a poker face as best they could.
One manufacturer invited him to visit their plant.
So I went down to visit where it's being made. And they showed me an assembly line, and they told me how safe it was, even though, because DuPont told them it was safe. And I said, well, that's nice at DuPont. But I went through the whole argument in the paper that it comes off, and it comes off as PFAS.
Graham's testing showed PFAS chemicals were shedding off the outside of the gear. But he decided to add to the evidence.
So I finally called up a friend in Australia, and I said, you guys got this suit, can you run it too? And they did it and said, yeah, we get those results too. And I was like, bang. And then we did that with a group at Harvard Public Health. And then we did a third study, the three papers in a year, bang, 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 came out.
The IAFF put out a statement that said that they see the Notre Dame study and view it as a tool and more research is needed. And I honed in on that like a peregrine falcon. I said, this is no tool. This is proof.
Diane arranged a phone meeting so Graham could explain what his study found.
In that phone call that we had with about 30 leaders of large organizations, we had members from the IAFF, we had members from International Association of Fire Chiefs, members from NFPA. The only people we didn't have were manufacturers. We did not want them in that meeting. We wanted the fire leaders to be able to absorb from the nuclear physicist what he was going to tell them.
Occasionally you run into a company that doesn't like being told, you know, oh, I don't use it. And I said, yes, you do. And he said, oh, no, we don't. We've got this proof. Here's our manufacturer in Sri Lanka that said we don't use it. And I look down the list and I say, well, this chemical down here is a PFAS. And they say, "What? It's a short chain PFAS. And they say, what's that? And I said, well, it's a different PFAS, but we tested for no PFAS. No, you tested for no long chain PFAS. They switched to short chain PFAS. Well, then those are safe, right? I said, no, they're actually more soluble. They're shorter chain. They get into the body easier. All sorts of things wrong with the short chain ones. Oh, it doesn't come off. And I said, no, it comes off more readily. Oh, well, is it still legal to do?
And yes, it was still legal to do. PFAS chemicals were not banned or restricted in how they could be used. The EPA had an agreement with the chemical companies to voluntarily stop producing PFOIA and PFOS. That was it. There were thousands of chemicals from the same PFAS family still produced and used in manufacturing. Rob Bellot's class action lawsuit shuffled along for 4 years, mainly because DuPont lawyers kept putting up roadblocks. But that gave Rob time to gather more and more damning evidence, evidence he needed to convince a jury of ordinary people that the toxicity of the chemical was real. He found documents about a study on rats done by 3M, the creator of PFOIA. The chemical caused birth defects in unborn rats.
They notified DuPont, who's their big customer for this stuff, the Teflon material.
That sent shivers through DuPont scientists. All female employees were removed from Teflon-related jobs, and they started reviewing the health records of 7 workers who'd recently given birth. 2 babies had been born with eye defects. In the general population, the expected rate of birth defects involving the eyes is 2 for every 1,000 births. At DuPont, 2 out of these 7 births had eye defects. This was never reported to anyone, not the mothers and not the EPA. And then Rob found some emails he knew would cinch his case.
Well, you know, this case was unusual in a lot of ways. And one of them was the fact that we were able to actually access a lot of these internal emails or memos from DuPont's own attorneys. A lot of them, you know, were turned over because, frankly, they were not privileged.
One was the minutes of a meeting where DuPont discussed tests they had done on water leaving the Washington Works plant. They had taken water samples more than 7 miles upriver from the plant, and they found PFOIA in samples from 2 communities, one in West Virginia and one just over the border in Ohio. In the meeting, the scientists suggest eliminating the use of PFOIA. The business side said doing that would essentially put the long-term viability of the business segment on the line.
there were folks within the company, particularly on the business side, were refusing to do the right thing here.
Like refusing to follow legal advice.
Actually, several of the attorneys in the company, one of them in particular, was expressing concern about the fact that this chemical, PFOA, was in the community's drinking water and people hadn't been told.
The lawyer was advising that DuPont should not only tell the community, but provide it with clean drinking water. The lawyer said,
"We are going to spend millions to defend these lawsuits and have the additional threat of punitive damages hanging over our head."
You had lawyers and a lot of very good lawyers, you know, that were trying to get their client, DuPont, you know, to do the right thing and, you know, to recognize what the science was showing.
This was big, very big for Rob's class action suit. And it didn't hurt that the New York Times published a story with a screenshot of the lawyer's memo. On September 1st, 2004, DuPont lawyers called Rob. The two sides met in Boston with their teams of lawyers, and over two 18-hour days, they hammered out an agreement. Although fine details of the agreement are secret, it included a provision to provide clean water to the community.
You know, we were fortunate that both sides were able to reach agreement after some intense negotiations.
The settlement also included something extraordinary.
We both sat down and agreed we would create something nobody had ever done before. We would create a panel of independent scientists. Three scientists both sides would pick. And believe it or not, we were actually able to agree on three scientists that had never worked for either side.
The science panel would work to find out what exactly PFOA could do to the people who'd been drinking the contaminated water. DuPont agreed to accept the panel's findings and would pay for all of it. If links to disease were found, a separate medical panel of three doctors would decide what kinds of medical testing would be needed. It was groundbreaking. And $50 million would be divided among the community members and another $20 million for health and education projects.
Was rather than just cut checks to everybody and walk away, which is what usually happens in big settlements like that, we decided we would use that money to pay people to come in, provide a blood sample, and fill out a health questionnaire, provide access to their data, then they would get a check. We had no idea whether people would actually do it.
And then they waited. But day after day after day, they watched as people lined up to give their blood and fill out the questionnaire and get their check.
You had a lot of people, thousands of people, who wanted to understand, you know, what's the extent of my exposure? And am I, in fact, at risk for serious disease here? And they wanted an independent, unbiased scientific answer to that. They didn't want, you know, something that was fed to them by the DuPont PR department or by, you know, what may be viewed as the plaintiff's lawyers. I mean, they wanted the information from the scientists.
In the community of 70,000, 69,000 rolled up their sleeve to give their blood. Only 1,000 didn't take part. That was an astounding number scientifically.
Having that level of participation was absolutely critical to being able to confirm these health impacts, particularly the cancers, where the scientists were telling us you typically need tens of thousands to find statistically significant levels. And we got that. We got a big enough sample size finally.
It took 7 years to analyze the data and publish a dozen studies. It was the biggest epidemiological study ever done on a chemical. And the data is available still to researchers today.
Nobody done this before, so we had no idea how long it would take. But it ultimately ended up confirming what we had seen in the documents from decades earlier.
The panel linked the chemicals to six diseases.
Kidney cancer, testicular cancer, ulcerative colitis, thyroid disease, preeclampsia, and high cholesterol. In fact, one of those cancers, testicular cancer, was the exact same cancer DuPont 3M had seen in their cancer study in the rats back in the 80s that they had been insisting was irrelevant to humans.
The study may have been groundbreaking in what it revealed, but much of the information was known to DuPont for decades. In 2003, as people were rolling up their sleeves to give blood, a series of articles were published using the documents Rob had filed in court. Environmental Working Group did a series of stories about PFOIA and PFOS. The organization tracks the chemical safety of all kinds of consumer products. The nonprofit advocacy group is run by scientists, policy experts, and lawyers. And its series pulled no punches. This is from one of the articles.
As more studies pour in, PFCs seem destined to supplant DDT, PCBs, dioxins, and other chemicals as the most notorious global chemical contaminants ever produced.
And this:
every new molecule of PFOA produced by the chemical industry in the coming years will be with us forever.
The series made big headlines, and just days after, the EPA made an announcement. After holding on to the information Rob shared about DuPont for almost 2 years, the EPA announced a priority review of PFOIA. That's the first step in determining if a chemical should be restricted or banned. That made DuPont executives pay attention. According to an investigation by the news organization The Intercept, DuPont put together a team filled with former EPA officials to deal with the regulators' review. One fellow who managed DuPont's communications had been the deputy administrator of the agency until a year earlier. A lawyer who replaced him was now working on DuPont's defense, and a former EPA director was on DuPont's board of directors. But even with all that high-powered help, DuPont didn't cooperate in the review to the EPA's satisfaction. In June of 2004, the EPA charged DuPont with 8 violations of failure to inform the agency of the toxicity of PFOIA, or C8 as DuPont called it, and covering up their own study showing the chemical could be transferred from a woman to her baby through the placenta. Other studies showed rats dying after inhaling it. Information DuPont had going back to 1981. This is an EPA spokesperson.
This information should have been immediately reported to EPA under DSCA Section 8E.
There was speculation the EPA was going to make an example of DuPont and fine them as much as $300 million. In December of 2005, the EPA announced with some fanfare the actual settlement.
The $10.25 million civil penalty that DuPont has agreed to pay is the largest civil administrative penalty EPA has ever obtained under any environmental statute.
There was another $6 million DuPont promised to spend on environmental projects. The Environmental Working Group said the fine was a drop in the bucket for DuPont.
The question is, you know, what is the right fine for a $25 billion company that pollutes the blood of every American with an indestructible chemical that causes cancer and birth defects in animal studies? I mean, we think it's certainly more than $16 million.
DuPont said it didn't deliberately withhold information from the EPA. It was just that the reporting requirements weren't clear. Here's their comment.
One option would be to litigate this thing till the cows come home, but we didn't think that was going to be productive. But what we hope will happen as we get through this is that the agency will provide more guidance to industry in terms of what needs to be submitted.
EPA regulations are pretty clear. If a substance or chemical being released into the environment is found to be hazardous, it must be reported immediately. DuPont's close relationship to the EPA showed up in documents Rob Bilott found as he prepared for his court cases. When the EPA's Science Advisory Board linked Teflon, one of DuPont's most valuable products, to cancer, and recommended classifying PFOIA, which was used to make Teflon, as a, quote, likely human carcinogen, the media attention struck fear in DuPont. The concerns were laid out in an internal email dated February 2006 by a DuPont vice president.
Situation analysis. Coverage has been broad in print and network media. Significant disruption in our market, and consumers are very, very concerned.
The email suggested the EPA should contradict its own science board.
In our opinion, the only voice that can cut through the negative stories is the voice of the EPA. We need EPA to quickly, like first thing tomorrow, say the following. Consumer products sold under the Teflon brand are safe. These include the non-stick cookware in your kitchen, the stain-resistant carpet in your family room, and the waterproof jackets in your closets, among other products which are valued by customers and offer unique and important benefits. Further, to date, there are no human health effects known to be caused by PFOA.
2 weeks later, the EPA's second-in-command announced there was no need for people to stop using cookware or other stain-resistant products because the EPA had no evidence the use of these products leads to PFOA exposure. So now, as word starts to get out about the PFAS family of chemicals, the companies say they'd stopped or were going to stop using PFOA and PFOS, two of the worst. They would find something else. But Rob points out that something else isn't really all that different.
What happened was the companies said, well, let's just take that and let's tweak it a bit. Let's knock a couple of carbons off. Instead of making C8, in other words, one of these chemicals with eight carbon chain, we'll knock two off. We'll make a new one called C6, and we'll rename it. We'll call it Gen X, and we'll start using that chemical in the same way we used C8. Or other companies made C4s, or now they start adding, and they make C9s or C10s.
So the clock starts all over again.
Well, what happens if you just tweak it, call it something new? Suddenly the companies will say, oh, well, wait a minute. All of the existing science, that's all on C8. You don't have that data on C4, C6, C9, C10. And we need to wait until we get all that data before we can regulate those.
The companies say the old science shouldn't apply to the new chemical that is actually very similar to the old chemical.
Well, what's happening in the meantime? All of us are exposed. We're getting exposed to these, and we're being told, well, let's wait and see how many people develop cancer over the next 20 years. Let's wait and see how many people actually get sick.
And wait for new science to prove to industry and regulator satisfaction that it's causing disease, polluting the water and the air. Next time on The Poison Detectives.
Are any of your companies that were responsible for using any of these chemicals that firefighters and military service members were exposed to planning any type of compensation to harmed victims? That's a question for all three of you.
At this point, the DuPont company is focused on cleaning up and remediating the sites which we operate. That's our focus, as well as reducing the amount of firefighting foam that we use in our sites. But that's the limit of where we're focused at this time.
So no.
We are focused on what we...
No.
What's in,
yes
within
or no.
Our control.
Yes or no.
We'll continue to focus on what's within our control.
That's not a yes or no answer. Yes or no. Are you planning at any point at compensating people who have been harmed by your company's chemicals?
This podcast is researched, written, and produced by me, Sandra Bartlett. Story editing by Backtrack Productions. Production assistance by Zara Kozema and David Mackay. The executive producer is Linda Solomon Wood. And thanks to Atlas Films for allowing me to use the audio you heard in the opening. It's from the 2019 documentary, The Devil We Know. You can watch the documentary on YouTube. This podcast received additional support from Creative BC and the province of British Columbia. Please give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. That helps people find us. And I love reading your comments. Thanks for listening.